City of Washington.
From 94.9 KUOW, this is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. Commencement, it means beginning. It's also the end of a phase of life for high school and college students. Coming up this hour, Dave Beck talks with a teacher and speaker about how to craft the right message to launch young people on the next phase of their lives. For the past couple of weeks on KUOW's Morning Edition, we've been running a series of stories about human trafficking on the national, international, and here in Puget Sound region. KUOW's Sarah Lerner has done extensive reporting on this subject, so we invited her into the studios today. And we wanted you, Sarah, to help us debunk some of the many myths that seem to circulate about human trafficking. So sure. Let's start big. What are some of the main things that you've heard that are false?
Well, for example, last week I talked to a community college class and one of the students asked me, why is Portland number one in the country for sex trafficking? And that's something that I hear actually quite a bit. And there isn't data that clearly backs that up. And I also hear that Seattle is number one in the country for sex trafficking and that the Pacific Northwest in general. And I hear quite a bit also that Washington State is third in the country for sex trafficking.
So where would these numbers come from?
Well, it very easily could be that what you have is more effective law enforcement on this issue here in this region, where you have people who are specifically targeting this issue, really honing in on it. There's a lot of attention to it here. And really, people that work on it in this area are very good compared to other parts of the country where they're really cooperative. Like advocacy groups work closely with the police, work closely with, state agencies, federal agencies. And in other places, that might not be the case. You know, you've got advocacy groups and police, and they're not even talking to each other. Also, the FBI has this Innocence Lost Project. So they specifically coordinate federal, state, local agencies, and they have these task forces, and there's three in this region. And they all work together really well, and they work closely with the FBI. And the FBI has been doing these nationwide sweeps. So since 2008, they've done six of them, all in one night in various cities. They make a large number of arrests, and they do this all across the country. They call it Operation Cross Country. And, you know, Seattle might have 16 arrests, and LA might have two. And people are taking that and saying, okay, therefore Seattle has the highest number of sex trafficking, which is not scientific.
No.
And so even the FBI is not, you know, they're not trying to say that they don't want people to extrapolate those kinds of stats out of the Operation Cross Country. I talked to somebody at FBI about that. I talked to Frederick Groot, who's a special agent here in Seattle.
The main thing to keep in mind about those statistics are they really represent just a snapshot in time. And they're intended to draw attention to the significant problem of child prostitution across the country. We're fortunate here in Seattle that we have a very very effective Innocence Lost task forces in Seattle, Everett, and Tacoma, working with our local partners. They're very involved and have active participation in all three of them.
You know, and it could even be that in other cities, they're also involved and they're working hard and they're doing a good job, but maybe they're just not participating in the Operation Cross Country.
So when they do these sweeps around the country, does Seattle always come out on top number-wise?
So they've done six of them, and in the first two, Seattle wasn't involved. And then in the last four, Seattle had higher numbers of – so what they do is they have minors recovered, they have a number of minors recovered, and they have numbers of associated arrests. And Seattle came out highest for minors recovered, higher than L.A. and Vegas anyway in the last four. So like in 2010, there was one where Seattle had 16 – and LA and Vegas didn't have nearly that high. They just had one or two.
But nevertheless, you might expect in Vegas and LA that...
Oh, it's absolutely a problem there. Absolutely. I mean, you can't take that as data, that it's not a problem. You have to look at all the other variables.
But let's just step back a second. There's a reason that the FBI and local
right.
law enforcement are doing these sweeps. It
yes.
is a problem.
Yes, exactly. Yes, absolutely. It's definitely true that it exists and it is a problem. It's just that it's like, I want to come out and be clear about what the reality behind it is and how big of a problem it is and how do we match up with the rest of the country. But it certainly is happening. And I've done a lot of reporting on it and I've talked to all the people that work with it and see it day to day.
So what are some of the other misconceptions about human trafficking?
One is that strip clubs are a gateway to sex trafficking, but there isn't really evidence for that. Another one that I do hear a lot is that the average age that a girl enters prostitution is 12 to 14. That it's just not clear where that data comes from. There is a lot of factors in there. I mean, a lot of people who end up in these, especially teenagers who end up in these sex trafficking situations, have suffered from sexual abuse at home. So they could be taking the numbers from that as well. But it's just not clear where that data comes from. And then the other really big one is just that sex trafficking is monumentally higher than other types of forced labor. But that's not true. Sex trafficking cases are easier to see. And I've been talking to a lot of people that work with this. I talked to a federal prosecutor who works right out of Seattle, Yiting Wu, and she says labor trafficking cases are also more difficult to investigate because they are so much more hidden. Here's Yiting.
You know, when somebody's walking by a motel in a dark area and they see a 14-year-old girl walk into a room, they know immediately something's not right there. Well, that's not going to be the same when you see a middle-aged woman from, let's say, Africa walking into a house in suburbia America, because they're not going to think one thing about it. They're not going to know that possibly that African woman is a domestic servant and she's being forced to work in that household.
So it's just much more difficult for the general public to be aware of it also.
I know when you did your series about human trafficking a few years ago, you focused a lot on legislative action. So I'm curious what the legislature is doing or has done about human trafficking.
Yeah, there is a definitely active. There's bills every session having to do with human trafficking. Last year, actually, there were 12 bills that had to do with human trafficking that passed. There's always even more that don't always get through. And it's a terrific bipartisan issue. I mean, who doesn't want to be against human trafficking, you know? So, and the ones that do pass, they pass with no one voting against it. So there's a lot of activity every year.
Are there actually effective bills that pass, or are these all just sort of lip service to the problem?
Well, they are bills that don't necessarily have a lot of funding behind them to really make big dramatic changes. And sometimes there are some well-intentioned bills that aren't that easy to enforce. One bill passed last year which steepens penalties for the so-called John, you know, the person who gets arrested with some kind of prostitution-related charge. And it made it so that this person's vehicle could get impounded. But if the case was dropped, then the person gets his money back, but the cities had to fork over that money. They couldn't get the money back from the state. So there's a new bill out this session that corrects that and makes the state pay the person back.
Anything else that you're looking at as something that could potentially be effective?
Well, there are four other bills that passed this session, and they all have to do with sex trafficking, that type of human trafficking. And they're various ways to increase enforcement against traffickers, like, you know, these pimps, basically, and trying to steepen penalties on these people who are arrested with prostitution-related charges.
And just to circle back to sex trafficking being the most visible form of human trafficking, when you did your series a couple of years ago, you actually didn't focus so much on that. I mean, really, you managed to find somebody to talk to that was much more sort of in the shadows.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's absolutely true. I mean, I focused my series on forced labor, that type of human trafficking, partly to show that that's a problem as well. And yeah, the person who I met, we called her Mary in the story. And she came over because this family, it was an acquaintance, and they had said, come and work for us. You know, you can come and work at our house. And she said no, because she was fine where she was. And then they kept asking her. She said no. And then they kept asking her. And then they said, well, we'll send your daughter to boarding school. And that would change her daughter's whole life. And so she agreed. And then she ended up in this situation where she didn't have the passport. She didn't know where she was, really. And she had to do nothing but sleep and then wake up and take care of a newborn baby plus another child and do all of the cooking, do all of the cleaning. And, you know, she just didn't have any way to get out of it, because that's what, and then, and this is what happens. You know, it's sadly, it's a case that is, has a pattern, you know.
KOW's Sarah Lerner has been covering the issue of human trafficking for many years. Thank you so much for coming in and sharing some of what you know with us.
Sure.
This is Weekday.
KOW 1016, storytelling, teaching, and inspiration in a minute. Support for KUOW comes from the Washington Academy of Languages, a division of CityU, providing foreign language learning opportunities to the Seattle community since 1979. Learn more online at wal.org.
55 degrees and cloudy in Seattle. Chance of showers today, and we expect to reach 69 degrees. 1017, I'm Bernard Ouellette. We're going to crank up the old-time machine and transport you back to the golden age of radio in 20 minutes.
Oh, that's such familiar strains of music. Last night, my son graduated from high school along with several hundred other kids at Roosevelt. In fact, all week, area high schools have held their commencement ceremonies. This Saturday, the University of Washington will cap off the graduation season with its massive ceremony. Dave Beck, my colleague at KUOW, is also the proud father of a high school graduate. Way that Seattle Public Schools do their ceremonies, it's always a doubleheader.
Yes,
every night at Memorial Stadium.
Well, first of all, congratulations.
Congratulations to you.
You know, I think it's amazing that we've been working together 18 years since our children were born, and you are a Roosevelt High School Rough Rider parent, and I am a Garfield High School Bulldog parent, yet we've managed to maintain collegial relationships.
Isn't that amazing? It's because neither of us went to either of those high schools. But, you know, it's interesting in the kind of swirl of emotions that a parent has, it's kind of, you have to put yourself in the kids' shoes when you listen to the speeches and the speechifying and really wonder, you know, what are the right words to launch a child?
Yeah, because it's, you know, it's a big time for parents and teachers. This is touching watching the teachers escort the kids out. And of course the kids are thinking, you know, what's next and what's around the corner. I met an English teacher recently from Lakeside School in Seattle. His name is Tom Dolger, and he started teaching at Lakeside actually the same year you and I started working at KUW in 1985. And took up teaching a few years before that as a profession, but it was the last thing he expected to do with his life. He'd been doing it for 37 years, but you know, is often called on to speak at the baccalaureate ceremonies. These are not the graduations itself, but a kind of reflective time. And you know, I was kind of asking him why he even gets that call, and it's because he loves to tell stories about his own life, about being at a crossroads, about, you know, what's going on next. He talks about that in context of the, you know, the poems and literature that he teaches, and then he's kind of an interesting life story himself that he passes along.
And so, you got a chance to talk. Let's hear it.
If there's any reason at all, I don't think it's because of the quality of that I'm a particularly astute and captivating teacher. Rather, I think it has something to do with my strategy of using stories as a teaching device. So I tend to tell stories in class that somehow illuminate some aspect of the poem or the play or the novel that we're reading. And because students, I think, love stories, even stories that aren't particularly well told, it's my guess that they want to be told the story.
Mm-hmm.
So I've been asked on some occasions to speak at the baccalaureate service. So,
at what point in your teaching career did you discover that story or personal story was an effective way to teach?
I think in the first year, in fact. I started teaching in the fall of 1974, and I thought perhaps a good technique would be to tell a story. And I can't remember what the text was at the time. And it seemed to me that the students were especially attentive when I began a story. So I thought this could work, and I've been working at it ever since.
Do you come from a family of storytellers?
I don't.
Really?
No.
Interesting. Yeah. And so you discovered that gift through teaching, or?
I think through reading literature. I was an English major in college, and I read many good stories. Mm-hmm. So, and I think all humans are essentially good storytellers if they reflect enough on the experiences that they've been having.
Mm-hmm.
Stories are woven into us, and they help us make meaning, it seems to me, out of our lives.
Yeah. It sounds like you came to teaching rather reluctantly. And what were you doing just before you took your first teaching job?
I was doing something very different from teaching high school students. I was a professional ski patrolman in Aspen, Colorado.
You were in your early 20s?
I was. I was 22, I think, at the time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How did you come to get that job? That's, you know, that's a coveted, glamorous thing to be doing.
When I reflect back on my life, I'm surprised at how many turns it's taken unexpectedly. I think for all of us, there's something at work. It's a double helix, sort of, between what we decide to do and fate or happenstance. So I was not planning on being a ski patrolman. I graduated from college, and I was 1A for the draft. The Vietnam War was at its height, and I was reluctant to serve. I didn't believe in the war. And it wasn't until the lottery that I knew I wasn't going to be drafted. So if my number in the lottery, it was November of 1969 that the lottery for the draft was instituted. When that particular evening when the numbers were drawn, my birth date came up as 282nd. And we who were draftable knew that if our birth date had been drawn in the first 90 draws, picks from the bottle, we probably would have had to serve in the military. And my number was 282, and I was free and clear. So what to do? The first thought that came to mind was to do graduate studies in English. I had been an English major. So I thought, go to Colorado and become a resident. To become a resident of Colorado, you had to live there for 6 months. Then I would apply for a state scholarship to attend the University of Colorado and get a master's in English. Well, I had a good friend. My best friend, in fact, was working in Aspen as a ski patrolman. And he said, well, if you're going to spend 6 months in Colorado, you ought to spend it in Aspen. So I thought that sounded like a good idea. And then I would go to the University of Colorado and get a master's degree. So my wife and I went to Aspen. And my friend convinced me that being a ski patrolman was the thing to do. So that's what we did.
So you must have been quite an accomplished skier. And...
It was a passion of mine.
Yeah.
So, yes.
Give me a sense of what it's like to be a young person working ski patrol in such a beautiful setting like that with, you know, with such responsibility. And, you know, it is a bit of a glamorous job to be a ski patrolman, particularly in a place like that.
I certainly felt it was glamorous. And we probably... had the mistaken idea that we were kings of the hill. And certainly of all those who served working for the Aspen Skiing Corporation, we considered ourselves to be sort of at the peak of the hierarchy, certainly more so than ski instructors or anyone else. We ran the area. We made it safe for people. We picked up people who were injured and took them to safety. And so we felt very proud of ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And it was indescribably wonderful if one likes being outdoors. We were fascinated, all of us. There were there are four mountains in Aspen. I worked on Snowmass. It was the largest of the ski. It is the largest of the ski areas there. There were 50 of us who were professional ski patrolmen. When I started, it was all male. There were so many attractive things about it. One was the skiing, obviously, which was amazing. At that time, about half the area that was permitted from the Forest Department, half of it hadn't been developed. And that was where we skied, was out-of-bounds skiing. And the out-of-bounds skiing was fantastic. We also felt responsible for controlling it for avalanches, both inbounds and out-of-bounds. So in the morning after a snowstorm, we would go out and blast particularly susceptible slopes, and then we'd ski them. And then the first aid aspect of the job was fascinating as well. We were, so far as I could tell, we were the highest paid patrol in the world at that time.
Mm.
And we would get our paychecks once every 2 weeks. And my colleagues and I would stare at our paycheck and wonder, they're paying us to do this. How astonishing. And the group of people that I worked with were wonderful. and a very eclectic collection of people, from Alaskan fishermen to loggers to PhDs in philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
And they were all, we enjoyed one another's company. We enjoyed the work that we did. We loved the first aid aspect of it.
Yeah. How did you even begin to think about leaving that job?
Well, I stayed there for 6 months. My wife and I stayed for 6 months and had a winter of the ski patrolling. And after the 6 months were up, it seemed very difficult to leave. So rather than going to the University of Colorado and seeking a scholarship from the state, we stayed for another 6 months, and then another 6 months, and then a couple more years, and then another year. So ultimately, we ended up staying 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
When we started off living in Aspen, it was difficult to find a place to live. Initially, we lived in a trailer court with one of my friends, or a friend who came to be a friend, a person on the ski patrol, and we rented a room at the back of his trailer. Ultimately, we ended up house-sitting for people, and accommodations became a good deal more comfortable than living in a trailer court. By the fourth year, we were caretaking a house that was on the side of Snowmass Mountain, and it was at the 9,000-foot level. Well, after the season closed for the area, I think we still had 3 feet of snow outside the front door of the place that we were caretaking. And there's too much of a good thing sometimes. And by May, it just seemed like we needed a break from living in Aspen and also seeing all that long winter of snow. To be honest, I couldn't imagine doing anything more satisfying, more thrilling than being a ski patrolman, particularly in Aspen. But it was a lot like having your favorite meal every single day, and then every single day, and then every single day.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have your favorite meal for a month, that might be fine. Several years, it becomes just a little tedious. So I think I was ready to take a sabbatical from ski patrolling after 4 years.
And how were things for your wife in that situation? I don't know if
she wasn't having the good time that I was having. So she was ready to leave certainly by the end of the fourth year, and we had just had a child. So my friends on the ski patrol would say, you know, this is a lot like living in Disneyland. Well, in a way, it certainly was, and it wasn't. When working on a person who had a heart attack, that seemed certainly real enough. Some of my friends died in avalanches when we did the avalanche work, but it was resort living, and resort living means almost a steady diet of hedonism. Aspen also had the extra dimension of a symphony in the summertime, ballet. So culturally, in the summertime, it was terrific. But most of the time, what people were going to Aspen, what people were visiting there for, was to have a rip-roaring good time, and that atmosphere also became a little tiresome mm-hmm. after a while.
So how did you shift from this amazing life in Aspen to your first teaching job, and was that a smooth transition?
I remember that one particular beautiful Colorado day in May with that 3 feet of snow out the front door, I put on a pair of cross-country skis and went up on the mountain and then came back down in the late afternoon. And just as I was taking off my skis, I heard the phone ring inside. And it happened to be an old, close friend who, graduating from college, he decided to become a secondary school teacher at a private boarding school. And he learned that there was going to be an opening at the school he was teaching at in the English department. And he thought I might be interested. So he was calling to find out if I would be. And would be interested and encourage me to apply if I happen to have an interest. So I thought about it. We had a very pleasant chat on the phone. After we rung off, I thought, well, I've done what I consider I am living, what I can't imagine to be. This is the most wonderful thing to do in life, to be a ski patrolman here in this place. What could be the worst possible thing to do? And if I wanted to experience the full range of what it is to be a human being, I thought teaching at a private school, teenagers, would be the worst possible thing. So I applied, and either foolishly or not, the school decided to hire me. So there was a big change in store.
Yeah. So you were a little bit cynical about the profession of teaching, it sounded like. Was that from your own experiences?
It was. Being a student was not all that satisfying for me. I aspired to mediocrity as a high school student. I felt sorry for most of my teachers. I thought they were a little pathetic, maybe, that they could have been doing other things with their lives more worthwhile than teaching obnoxious teenagers such as myself. And I also thought they're not fully human. Perhaps in the evenings they're put into coat closets and they're not brought out until the morning. And then they go to in their classrooms and they teach us. Well, I was wrong.
So you stepped into this classroom, and I mean, you've described it as a kind of epiphany, and you even told me at one point that you felt the same sort of exhilaration, or you came to feel the same sort of exhilaration in teaching as you did on the slopes at Aspen. And how did that ever happen?
Darned if I know. I think it's much more exhilarating to be a teacher than it is to be a ski patrolman, for me, in my experience. And after the first day, it was one of those transformative experiences of teaching, the first day of teaching teenagers. I realized by the end of the day that my life was determined, that I was going to be a teacher for the rest of my life. I just felt this is it. There was this conviction, which I had never felt before in my life, that this was going to be what I should devote my life to.
I mean, how did that happen? I mean, you discovered a calling on that day. And can you help me understand what took place?
Well, nothing dramatic, nothing so dramatic that it would make sense that I felt by the end of the day, this is what I'm meant to do. I think I was fascinated. I hadn't had much experience working with teenagers before. So being in the classroom with them, I think what I came to appreciate almost immediately was how fascinating they are. This is, from my point of view, the most interesting part of a person's life in many respects, maybe the most painful as well for many people. It's certainly the time in which more change happens, I think, in an individual than at any other time in a person's life, at least in our culture. So when, and I think I intuitively sense this, when a student enters into the ninth grade in the United States, the student is either a boy or a girl, and by the time they graduate, they're 17 and 18. They're young men and young women. And there's a huge transformation that takes place psychologically, physically, of course, and intellectually. What a fascinating time.
Hmm. You say that that they make you laugh.
They do. It's one of the great rewards of teaching, it seems to me, is teenagers are funny either because they intend to or even unintentionally funny. So I find myself laughing much of the day, even after 30. So I've been teaching for 37 years now, and I think I'm laughing more now than ever before.
Teenagers get the rap, and sometimes deservedly so, for being so self-involved and you know, understandably being perhaps a bit insecure with all the changes in front of them, all the unknowns on the horizon. But what do you try to do in your teaching, in your storytelling, in the way that you teach literature to help them get beyond that sense of just being so self-involved?
I think being a teenager, so teenagers, in my observation, have plenty of warts and shortcomings. And because I so admire them, I'm drawn even to their shortcomings. They are trying to figure things out. They are trying to make meaning of their lives. They're trying to understand who they are, and helping them to make meaning, helping them to understand who they are, is dynamic and fascinating work, which I'm still trying to puzzle out how to do most effectively. I think I need several lifetimes to become a mentor teacher, to become a teacher who really understands teaching. I'm on a steep learning curve still after 37 years. This doesn't happen with every single class, but I would say 90% of the time, the fulfilling aspect of teaching is the teaching itself. So by the end of a class, when I walk out of the classroom, I'm thinking, this is about the best thing I can imagine doing. There are sometimes teaching ninth graders when they're really squirrely and they're sort of out of line, and I leave the classroom not having done a very good job of keeping them focused and in order. And this is the 10% where I'm thinking, oh my goodness, I'm a failure. I hope nobody discovers that I really don't know how to teach. But most of the time, it is so satisfying. Teenagers tend to be willing to be spontaneous in ways that I find adults don't. They're willing to be more transparent than adults tend to be. They're willing to be more curious because they're just thinking about abstract thoughts, about the meaning of life, about what they're supposed to be doing, and about who they are. Mm-hmm. And all these questions, which are so important for all of us, they're wrestling with and trying to discover the answers, to be with them as they're considering these questions and looking for the answers is a privilege.
Tom Folger has taught English at Seattle's Lakeside School since 1985. He spoke with KOW's Dave Beck. Tom's collection of stories and reflections delivered at graduations other settings is called On Occasion, Tom Folger Speaks, Dolger Speaks. The information to that is at our website, kuow.org/weekday.
Another turning point, a fork stuck in the road. Time grabs you by the wrist, directs you where to go. So make the best of this test and don't ask why. It's not a question but a lesson learned in time. It's something unpredictable, but in the end is right. I hope you had the time of your life.
10:39. In a minute here, we're going to meet the woman behind Let's Pretend. What does that mean, the woman behind Let's Pretend? Well, we're about to find out.
KUOW and the Fry Art Museum present Buster Simpson, Surveyor, the first retrospective survey of work by a Seattle artist dedicated to working in the public realm, June 15th through October 13th. More on the events page at kuow.org.
Next time on Latino USA, Latino graduates. It's an American family tradition, but what do Latinos with college degrees face in the future?
Humanity in the abstract will never inspire you the way meeting another human being will. Poverty is not going to motivate you to do something, but meeting people, that will motivate you to do something.
That's next time on Latino USA.
That's tonight on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from the Dairy Farmers of Washington, renewing their commitment during June's National Dairy Month to healthy cows, product quality, and a clean environment. More about what dairy families in Washington are doing to keep milk pure, fresh, and local is online at akeyingredient.com.
56 degrees and cloudy in Seattle. Chance of showers this afternoon with some clearing at times and a high of 69. It's 10:40. The Supreme Court ruled today that human genes cannot be patented. That and more of today's news in 20 minutes.
Quiet, please. In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
This is Jack Benny talking.
Jordan, Rocky Jordan.
Have you ever danced with a murderer?
This is Orson Welles, speaking from London.
King County.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, cast your ears back to the golden age of radio. And, as is unfortunately typical and to be expected, there weren't a lot of female directors during the golden age of radio. And Katie Sewell thought we should spend the radio retrospective segment today highlighting the career of one of the most respected female directors of the golden age. Great.
That's right. Her name was Nyla Mack. And she ultimately became known for this show.
Pretend.
Well, hello, pretenders.
And she ultimately became known for this show.
Let's pretend. Well, hello, pretenders. Well, thank you for that great big welcome. Sybil, what's our story?
The all-time favorite of all the years, Uncle Bill, Cinderella.
And Arthur Anderson says how we travel.
Well, on a brisk morning like this, what could be sweeter than a brisk gallop through the park?
Well, fine, Arthur. Give every man a horse he can ride, and away we go. All right, girls and fellas, head straight for Let's Pretend. Turn left for the story of Cinderella. Let's go.
Katie, never heard of this show. Never have heard it.
How can that be true?
This is the hard-boiled detectives.
This was the most successful radio show for kids during the Golden Age, Steve.
Is that right? So a lot of our listeners are going to say, are going to have had their minds blown. They've just taken back in time.
They just realize that you don't know anything about radio whatsoever.
That too.
it ran from 1930 to 1954.
Wow.
That is a really long run. And it was carried by more stations than most shows were, too.
Wow.
But doing a kid's show was never anything that Nyla Mack actually set out to do. She was an only child. Her father was a railroad engineer and her mother was a dance instructor. And she loved performing arts from a very young age. And her parents, doting on their only daughter, encouraged her. They trained her to sing and dance.
Right.
She acted in plays. They made sure she learned how to play the piano. And even in interviews, she'll admit that she was kind of spoiled by them. But she had several major tragedies.
They were just nurturing her inner arts and soul, and they did a good job.
Well, they did send her to finishing school. she had several major tragedies, however, in her young life. Her father was the only person killed in a terrible train derailment, though he was alive long enough for her mother and Nyla to have a chance to talk to him before he passed away. And it's quite, the derailment story is an amazing story. Yeah, people should really look it up and read it. I was going to go into it, but then I thought I was getting too far off
track.
But
just Google Nyla Mack.
Nyla Mack, yeah. Maybe I'll put a link up where you can actually read life story. Her husband, who was an actor named Roy Bryant, died quickly, leaving her a widow by the age of 35. And in 1929, CBS had hired her to be a radio actress, but she ended up having to quit to take care of her mother in Arkansas City. So she has all these things that kind of, you know, make her stumble. But this is where things start turning around. So she's in Arkansas City. She doesn't want to just sit around in her old hometown. So instead, she becomes the program director of the new Arkansas radio station that's starting up. And she learns everything from radio writing to selling advertising. And then when CBS comes calling in 1930, she knows she's ready because she's done all these different things. And they wanted to hire her to direct their very struggling kids show, The Adventures of Helen and Mary. Now, she was surprised. She said to them, really, you want a childless widow to save your kids' show? That was her response. I don't even like kids, is what she was telling friends of hers. But it was the Depression, and she didn't think that turning down a really good job was an option at that point. So she agreed. But she really didn't like adventure shows. She liked fairy tales. And so it didn't take her long to turn this struggling adventure show into Let's Pretend.
What is your name?
They call me Cinderella, Your Highness.
My lovely Cinderella, once more I ask you, will you be my bride and queen and rule my kingdom with me?
In spite of my rags, you ask me to be your queen?
In spite of everything, you're the most precious thing in life to me. Will you say you'll marry me?
Yes, my prince, I will.
In spite of her rags, Katie. In spite of your rags, Katie, I know why you love this show.
Oh, I'm glad you noticed that final speech. Nyla wrote these scripts, most of them.
Really?
And she directed the show. And she frequently was the one that composed the music as well. She operated on the theory.
She composed the music, too?
Yeah, she's a piano player, an accomplished piano player. She can do everything, Steve. She operates on the theory that fairy tales are a child's guide to the eternal truths of life. That was her theory. And
well,
as you heard in that final speech...
As many a scholar will agree with her on that.
Yes. And as you hear in that final speech that the prince made, she wrote the scripts so that they delivered a clear moral lesson, even if it meant changing the story's ending. For example, take Snow White and the Seven Dwarves. First of all, she renamed Snow White Snowdrop for some reason. I'm not sure why. And she wasn't about to have the story end with
Snow. She's going to get sued by Disney or in the future.
Well, yeah. Disney, that movie hadn't come out yet.
I know.
And she wasn't about to end her story with Snowdrop just abandoning her dwarves in the woods while she moved into a castle.
Come, dwarfs. Our procession has changed from one of sorrow to great happiness. Come.
Where, Your Highness?
To the palace, where all of you will be made welcome. And have a home always.
Oh, how nice. Thank you, dear prince. I couldn't live without my little friends. You will come, won't you?
Can we see Snowdrop every day?
Yes, Yaha.
And have pudding every day?
As often as you want it.
She also used her scripts to speak out about racial prejudice. She even wrote an original drama called Castles of Hatred to combat the fairy tale idea that all stepmothers are cruel.
Oh, she sounds great.
She's great. Her cast was also unique in the world of radio theater. Let's listen to the credits from the earlier Cinderella episode.
The pretenders for today were Cinderella.
Marilyn Erskine.
The Prince.
Albert Alley.
The Stepmother.
Miriam Wolfe.
Isabella.
Gwen Davies.
Flora.
Daisy Alden.
The Fairy Godmother.
Sybil Trent.
The Page Boy.
Jack Rhymes.
The Driver of the Coach.
Arthur Anderson.
These stories are dramatized and directed by Nyla Mack.
Now, no matter how sophisticated those people may sound, they are all kids.
Those are all kids?
All of them. Wow. Nyla believed that to bring fantasy and magic and a sense of unreality to the radio, child actors were the only way to do it.
Really?
Mm-hmm. And she hired kids ages 6 to 16. So those people you heard are all in that age bracket. And she trained them very slowly. She allowed them to become excellent radio actors over time, just starting them with little tiny bit parts, moving them up, so that they're taking over as the others are getting older. Eventually, she ends up with a company of 40-plus child actors that she can call on. So let's listen to another scene, keeping in mind now that these are all kids.
Your father was one of the many victims of Bulibus.
Bulibus? The giant who lives in the Granite Mountain?
Yes. He killed your father, destroyed our home, and took every piece of gold we had.
A monster.
Yes, Jack, but that's past and done. The point is, what are we going to do now?
Let's listen to one more example. This is from Beauty and the Beast.
Yes, here is a perfect rose. I'll pick it.
How dare you pick my roses?
What a hideous beast! Awful.
Wasn't it enough that I gave you the freedom of my castle, fed you and sheltered you?
Who are you? What is this ghostly place?
I'll show you by eating you alive.
No, please don't kill me.
Those are all kids.
All kids.
That's remarkable.
It's
That's great.
So impressive once you know that. I didn't know that. I've heard Let's Pretend for years. I had no idea they were all kids.
That's wonderful.
The kids credited Nyla with their acting talent later on in their lives. Arthur Anderson was a person who was in her acting company for his whole childhood. And he put it this way. He said, I sincerely believe that Nyla made actors out of many of us who would have otherwise been doomed to quick fade-outs.
Hmm.
Once their cute voices were gone.
Yeah, that's it.
Career could have been over.
That's wonderful.
The CBS network also recognized that Nyla Mack was incredibly talented. They promoted her to director of children's programming. She worked on the 14th floor of CBS, the CBS's building in New York City, right down the hall from Edward R. Murrow.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
So Edward R. Murrow and Nyla Mack were
Yep, and Norman Corwin was also there.
And Norman Corwin.
Mm-hmm.
That's great.
It's not bad for a woman who started out disliking children.
That's a great story. All right, I will find out more about Let's Pretend. You'll put some links up so people can find out more, too.
I will.
Katie Sewell produces Radio Retrospective. I just come in lately and just get a chance to talk with her. It's good to see you again.
Good to see you, too.
This is Weekday.
It is the day, Thursday, the time we check in with food writer Sarah Dickerman. And, Sarah, you are back with us from the East Coast where you've been eating yummy things.
I have. I ate a lot of seafood, I have to say, while I was out there and really enjoyed being on Cape Cod, which is just an incredible environment. It's got oceans and lakes and a bay beach, so you have all sorts of explorations to do.
The Atlantic has different seafood than the Pacific.
It does. It's time for my yearly indulgence in swordfish, which I really only eat once a year. They also have razor clams, but they're quite different from the razor clams we might get. They're a little skinnier, and you can they're not gritty at all. You just throw them on the grill perpendicular to the grill, and they're quite delicious.
That sounds so fun. So your recommendation for lunch today is that we all fly to Cape Cod?
Exactly.
Okay, good. I'm leaving now. Let's go.
But should you not be able to do that, you could take... some people live out in the Snoqualmie Valley, but some people might be thinking about a bike ride or some farm visiting out in the Snoqualmie Valley. And I was going to recommend a place called the Grange Cafe in Duval.
Yes, and it's an old Grange Hall, right?
It's a Grange Hall. So just the building itself is a treat. It's, you know, big, simple, but, you know, impressive, big building. And you walk in and it's kind of got a long space with wooden floors and some farm implements on the wall to remind you of the past. And it's just a really nice, very simple cafe. I think it does breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And for lunch, you'll get things like a really good BLT, a really good club sandwich, or a hamburger, and then just nice little details, like I got a green salad on the side of my club sandwich, and there were little bits of tarragon strewn through this beautiful, very fresh spring green salad.
Well, so that sounds like any kind of restaurant burgers. What makes this different?
I think just it's notable to be, I think, in a less not urban place where people are really paying attention to the sourcing of the ingredients. So a lot of this stuff comes from the local farms right within Snoqualmie Valley. And just the details, you know, the crisp bacon, the extra moist turkey on a sandwich, freshly made focaccia as the bread, all those little details add up. It's not necessary always to have, you know, an incredibly innovative menu to have a really satisfying dining experience. And I like that the details they put together here.
Did you find this by riding your bike by?
No, I actually was visiting Oxbow Farm for a story I was working on, and I do know about it because the farmer at Oxbow, Luke Woodward's sister, is one of the owners of the Grange.
So it's called the Grange Cafe, and if you link to it, you'll see they've actually got breakfast, lunch, and dinner, all three meals. So you can make a really big day out of it, I guess. You know, someday we should start a breakfast show because breakfast is pretty yummy, too.
Well, I'm all for that.
Now, for those of us who want to step into the kitchen and maybe not be on our bicycles or driving in anywhere in any destination, you are recommending a graphic cookbook. I don't know what to call it, a comic cookbook. Mm-hmm. You know, what is this exactly?
Well, it's actually a graphic memoir, and I'm a huge fan of graphic fiction and nonfiction. Written by Lucy, I have to think it's Kneesley or Kneesley?
Knisley.
Knisley, there we go. And it's called Relish, and it's a memoir of growing up with parents who just are obsessed with food, and sort of her perspective as a child growing up through this, and it's interspersed with recipes that are actually, you know, cartoon or comics. So what I like about this kind of recipe is that it kind of makes each ingredient almost into an action hero within the recipe.
Mr. Carrot?
Yeah, and so she has, you know, how to saute mushrooms the way her mother did, and it's just very funny. You know, there's a scene where the mushrooms, she discusses what happens after they've been in the pan for a while. They'll start to squeak, and, you know, she, of course, has, you know, this great lettering that's like, squeak, and, and, you know, little details, you know, like use a dish towel when you're shaking the pan so you don't burn your hand, that you can actually incorporate very easily visually that might take up more words than you'd want to use if you're writing the recipe out simply. And I just think it's got a real charm and a real invitation to the kitchen. I know that my daughter, also, who's 5, really loves this book it's a reprint of a French book called La Cuisine est un jeu d'enfant, which means that cooking is child's play. Mm-hmm. And she, too, like, she looks at these graphic recipes, and for her, that just makes her want to jump in the kitchen. And so I think there's something lovely about this book. It's a very sensitive, somewhat short memoir, but it made me think that it would be a great gift for teenagers, maybe graduates and stuff like that, who are just sort of thinking about their own identity. It's a lovely little book.
Is it aimed at young audience?
No, I don't think so. I mean, it's a nice, it's good for grown-ups too, but there's something about her. She seems young. She seems like she's still in the process of figuring out who she is, and I feel like there's a really lovely observation of that moment in life.
So it seems like the theme for today, Sarah Dickerman, was sort of well done, simple.
Yes, exactly.
I don't know if you thought about that. Maybe you're having to recover from razor clams, swordfish, oysters, and all the things that are sort of, you know, a little bit decadent for us here on the West
right.
Coast.
Well, my favorite things in the world are well-done, simple things, and so I like to recognize it sometimes in what I'm thinking about.
Sarah Dickerman has recommended The Grange Cafe in Duval and Relish, My Life in the Kitchen by Lucy Nisley. Sarah, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you so much.
Sarah Dickerman writes about food for Bon Appetit, Slate, New York Times, and other publications. You can find her online at her website, sarahdickerman.com, and on Twitter, at Sarah Dickerman. And now, the sound of the day. Beep, 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 beep.
Kind of sounds like one of those old school adding machines.
It does.
With the receipt paper on it.
Yeah, and what you get instead of a receipt are cookies, ginger snaps. This is a sound of a kitchen. Listener Kim recorded it with her small metal spatula, the sound it makes when she moves freshly baked ginger snaps from their metal baking pan onto a metal cooling rack. But doesn't it sound like she's ringing a bell each time?
Totally.
She says she wished she could record the smell of the kitchen right now. Well, Kim, we wish we could have the taste of the ginger snap right now. What interesting sounds are you listening to in the world around you? We invite you to record 30 seconds of what you hear and send it to us along with the story behind the sound. You email your audio file to weekday@kuow.org and be sure you include sound of the day in the subject line and, you know, send us that virtual ginger snap as well. Weekday is produced by Katie Sewell, Jason Pagano, and Amina Al-Sadi. Bernard Ouellette is our engineer. I'm Marcy Silman. Tomorrow is Friday. Our panel of journalists will be in to look back at the week's news, including today's Supreme Court decision that you cannot patent human genes. That's all coming up tomorrow. I hope you'll join us.
KOW's weekday program begins tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock. I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 10:59. It's good news for prisons, but bad news for other state agencies if lawmakers in Olympia can't reach a budget agreement by the end of the month. Lisa Brooks has more in the news, which is right around the corner.
Support for KUOW comes from Graham and Dunn, a full-service law firm focused on helping Northwest businesses tackle challenges faced on the path to success. Online at grahamdunn.com, located on Pier 70. Business law from a different point of view.
A starchy root called cassava feeds millions of people across Africa.
So this is the cassava.
But a plant virus is making some cassava roots inedible.
You cannot consume this cassava.
Scientists might have a solution. It could yield a disease-free cassava harvest, but it involves genetic modification and the uncertainty that goes with GMOs. That story on The World.
That's later today on KUOW's Afternoon News Magazine, which airs from 3 to 8 p.m.
Support for KUOW comes from STG, presenting singer-songwriter Nico Case at the Paramount Theater on September 18th. Tickets on sale this Friday, 10 a.m. at the Paramount Box Office, 24-hour kiosk, or online at stgpresents.org.